Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive here of the RSA. I'm losing my voice, but it doesn't matter because I'm not your speaker. Delighted to welcome you to this afternoon's special event. We don't normally use the Great Room for lunchtime events, but when you've got a speaker of this magnitude and brilliance, then you know you use your best venue. Before we begin, quick reminder to turn your mobiles to silent. We're filming today's event, live streaming over the web, so welcome to everyone who's joining us online and contributing through their online contributions to our collective intelligence. The hashtag is RSABigMind if you want to get involved either in this room or online. Now, housekeeping notices over. It's my great pleasure to welcome our distinguished guest and my friend, Jeff Mulgan. Jeff needs little introduction to RSA audiences. Chief Executive of Nesta, he's one of our foremost public thinkers on innovation, someone who's consistently ahead of the curve in anticipating and persuasively analysing the key trends shaping our society and economy. He joins us today to share his the latest thinking from his new book, Big Mind, which surveys the field of collective intelligence that has emerged in recent years, supported by a wave of new digital technologies that make it possible for organizations and societies to think better at large scale. In the book and in his talk here today, Jeff shows how this intelligence has to be carefully organized and orchestrated in order to fully harness and direct its powers. In fact, he argues, figuring out the most effective ways to design and foster collective intelligence could be seen as our biggest current challenge, since there's little prospect of solving our other grand challenges of climate, health, prosperity, war, or indeed how it is we manage technology itself without progress in how we think and act together. So, of course, finding collective solutions to collective problems is exactly what we're grappling with across several of our current research projects here at the RSA. So it's a particular pleasure to hear from Jeff today, and we are going to we'll plagiarise all his best ideas, as we always try to do. After Jeff has spoken for 20 or so minutes, I'm going to be engaging him in a challenging conversation, and I'm going to open it up to you to join in, and we'll finish at 2. But enough from me. It's time to get started. Please welcome Jeff Mulgan.
Well, many thanks, Matthew, and thank you all for being here on a cold, miserable, grey January lunchtime to this building, which in a way is a kind of temple to collective intelligence over several hundred years and about to be refashioned into its extraordinary new coffee house formats, which congratulations. And what I'll try and do is give you a flavour of the argument of the book in order, I hope, to prompt you to agree violently with some of it, but also to disagree. And one of the points I make in the book is actually argument is one of the things which is essential to collective intelligence. So I hope we don't have too much consensus here. And Matthew's assured me he disagrees with lots of it. So that will get us started. The reason I was interested in writing this book was really came from a career, probably like quite a lot of you, of working in organisations of all kinds, where many of us try to make our institutions, our communities, a bit less dumb than they would be otherwise. I've worked a lot in government, which is often a case study of collective stupidity, and sort of feel a sort of personal urge to understand, you know, why did things go wrong? What could we have done differently? And over the last few years, I've been even more struck by some of the paradoxes of intelligence at scale. I think the kind of fairly obvious one that you all have in your pocket, some of you pointing at me, you know, incredibly smart devices, but it's quite hard to look at the world as a whole and conclude it's necessarily becoming collectively more intelligent. And I'm sort of looking for how does one, again, make sense of those macro trends. Within institutions, not just in the financial crisis, but other moments, we've seen the very organizations which spent most on clever people and clever technology often made the most stupid, basic errors of judgment. Martin Luther King, many decades ago, spoke about so guided missiles and misguided men as being one of the sort of features of modernity. And there was a nice comment just a few weeks ago, I think it was from Annie Prue, about the internet, which was sort of hoped to be, and in many ways I think is, an extraordinary step forward in global collective intelligence, but as she put it, has also often given us a tsunami of garbage, and which we then wade through and often drown in. So my background, apart from working in various organizations, is a PhD in telecoms. So I'm sort of inherently interested in understanding information flows, network structures, how knowledge is organized. And I think one of the virtues of living in a digital era and being surrounded by smartphones and internets and AI and so on is it makes you analyze more precisely how information is flowing, how decisions are being made, etc., than perhaps was the case in a world not so immersed in formal sort of software and hardware. And that was my starting point in this book for trying to make sense of both a theory and a practice of intelligence at large scale, as I say, something the RSA has been doing for nearly 300 years. To draw on for doing that, there are many strands, and the book draws on many disciplines and experiences. Some are quite well known, like the sort of wisdom of crowds arguments of the, I think in many ways, fantastic book from the early 2000s, which started with Francis Galton's famous 19th century example of getting a crowd to have to guess the weight of a cow. And many of you will know, and the crowd guesses it more accurately than even the expert individuals. And there are many examples of that. And yet, that sort of theory of the wisdom of crowds has often been misinterpreted, has often gone horribly wrong, because crowds, in reality, can be as often deluded, totally wrong, biased, as they can be wise. And a lot of the book is about how do you actually make crowds wise and not just assume that aggregating opinions gets you to the right examples, as in Francis Galton's case. There are also many, I think, fascinating and indeed inspiring contemporary cases of collective intelligence in practice. Citizen science projects with millions of people counting birds or studying the stars, the contributors to Wikipedia, and more recent examples like Duolingo. I don't know how many of you have used Duolingo to learn a new language, which is a combination of machine intelligence and thousands of volunteers helping to populate language pairs to create a new and, I think, remarkable service for the world. There are elements in many disciplines. Economics has a whole history of analyzing information and transaction costs, social psychology, team analysis. One of the nicest things I came across in the literature on teams, which many of you may know well, is why burglars do better in teams than working alone, and how many examples there are of where small collaborations get better results than operating alone. And yet, one of the, I guess, the other prompts for doing the book was, if you're asked by someone running an organization or the mayor of a city, how can I get my collective, my group, to think better, there's surprisingly little to guide them, either in terms of serious theory or serious practice, let alone how should the world go about thinking about solving very complex problems like air quality or climate change or public health. So what I've tried to do, and I'll just give you a very sort of a flavour of some of the book, is partly to go back to basics with some thought experiments about how in practice thought happens. I started with a garage at the end of my road. And just looking at an institution like that, or it could be a coffee house or a shop, as a cognitive system, how does it think? How does it interpret what's going on in its environment, what decisions it needs to make, how to respond to customers, how to price things, how to deal with new technologies, in the case of a garage, like hybrids or electric cars? This actually gives a lot of insights into how a real economy works. I use the experiment, the thought experiment, of a group of passengers, maybe about this sort of number. Imagine you're all stranded, perhaps in the RSA or an airport, and the lights go out, all contact with the outside world ceases. How would you, together, become a collective intelligence, able to work together to understand what's happening to you, what your options are, to feed yourselves, keep yourselves warm, to escape? And in those examples, we get to some of the crucial elements, which then also explain why much grander projects like the climate change negotiations in Paris or the IPCC help the world deal with big issues of carbon, etc. And the starting point there is to think of collective intelligence rather as individual intelligence happens, as composed of a number of elements, which are in some ways quite distinct. The ability to observe, to see the facts, the data, the ability to generate models of how the world is likely to work, the ability to remember, to predict, to create, to judge, and so on. And as I show, these are each quite distinct. They can be done well or badly in a community or an organization. Some of them are hugely helped by technologies. We can observe dramatically more than in the past. We can make some kinds of prediction much more efficiently than in the past. Others, not at all. And others, like judgment and creativity, have been so far rather less influenced by digital technologies. But at least that gives us a frame for understanding the garage, the firm, the university, or the parliament as a cognitive creature. I then look at a whole series of theories to make sure, see how you pull those things together. And I think the one I'll just share here is a notion of triple loops of learning, which tend to be essential for any group or collective to be recognizably intelligent. And a simple way of thinking about this is driving kids to school in the morning, which probably some of you did. And the first loop learning is essentially what you do, perhaps trying out different routes and seeing which one is fastest. And there you've got a frame, a theory, which you test out and improve while leaving the frame intact. Second loop learning comes when that runs into barriers and problems, and perhaps you discover that air quality of your neighbourhood matters a great deal. And then you have to generate new categories for thinking about your act driving your kids to school as contributing to pollution, carbon, etc. And third loop learning is when that runs into barriers and you change the whole way in which you think. And the possible transition to driverless cars with an entire sort of data system and platform managing their flows would be an example of third loop learning. And so what we recognize as intelligence at scale always consists of strong capabilities like observation, memory, etc., and well-orchestrated learning loops which are able to adapt in practice. In a moment, I'll say a bit about how I apply that in practice. To feed into this, I've also then tried to look at the history of collective intelligence, including coffee houses and the science system. And the example I probably like most of all, which I hadn't been aware of, was the Oxford English Dictionary, which in the 1850s was an extraordinary prescient example of trying to mobilize many, many brains to solve a really complex problem. In that case, to find the meanings of every word in the English language and the history of every meaning. An extraordinary venture, which of course couldn't be done by a Samuel Johnson or a single individual. And the group who set out on that deliberately mobilized armies of volunteers to read little bits of English literature with various pieces of slips of paper to record dates, volumes, and so on. And eventually, 6 million slips of paper later and 20 years, they had the Oxford English Dictionary. Almost everything which Wikipedia did more than 100 years later was actually already designed into the OED and launched in a building very near here in the 1850s. And there are many other examples from the past of these attempts at highly structured orchestration of many, many brains. There are also much more recent ones, which I found useful, like NASA's work. So NASA, in getting someone onto the moon, employed about 400,000 people in 20,000 organizations, an extraordinary exercise of very large-scale coordination. And more recently, NASA has been one of the funders of experiments in collective intelligence, like hiding red balloons across the US and offering prizes for teams to find them using various incentive structures and communication structures. And in each case, it only takes a few hours for all of these to be found, even though there is no hierarchy or organization to do so. So looking at these examples is, to my mind, useful, fascinating, and telling. And various key patterns come out, which I think are non-obvious. So one is a key to look at the pathologies of collective stupidity. One pathology comes when you have an imbalance of the elements of intelligence. If you're too obsessed with observation, you tend to make really stupid mistakes, and arguably Stalinism was an example of that. And some of the very data-driven financial organisations get was intoxicated by the flow of input that it squeezes out the space for judgment. Other organisations or communities become trapped in too much memory, or too much creativity can be almost as bad. If you're spending all your time, you know, creating the new, you may forget to protect yourself against the old, and so on. So there's a lot of insights about balance, about the failure to cultivate the second and third loop of learning, and so becoming trapped, and also about the conflicts there are in collective intelligence in the wild, both the challenges of disinformation, trolling, the deliberate attempts to undermine the collective intelligence and others, and our own internal tendency to seek out confirmation, etc. And this takes us to some of the practical implications of the theory, some of which are about how do we build institutions which can reinforce our own collective intelligence, can guard against those threats. Some of them are some of those familiar ones, like audit. Audit is meant to be a protection against deception, misinformation. Things like what works centres within our governing system, our attempt, again, at a protection against collective stupidity. And within our own habits of mind, learning, self-criticism, cultivation of argument, etc., all are our own tools. The second half of the book is all about applying that in practice. And I'll give a very quick flavour of that. I think for many people that's probably the most useful part of the book, is looking at, in some ways, familiar things through, I hope, a fresh lens. So, for example, democracy, looking at how a parliament works, how a city like Reykjavik or a Barcelona works, as those places are trying to use new methods of tapping the intelligence of their citizens to observe, to judge, to create, to come up with new solutions. We've now got some fantastic examples and some quite mad examples. Indeed, Beppe Grillo, the leader of the Italian movement Five Stars, in fact, this week published a long thing on this book because he sees some of these tools as a way to break out of their political passes. I look at things like meetings. What have we learnt about the meeting? And here I am speaking at you from a lectern. I mean, one of the points I make is actually there's a lot known about what allows meetings to tap the collective intelligence of their participants. The vast majority of meetings in politics, in business, in academia, completely ignore everything that is known about what makes meetings good or makes them tap into, you know, the gold inside your heads. And I think there are some good answers about how we reshape meetings to do that that better. The final point I want to make is really, I guess, the heart of where I hope this book points to the future. And this is really to ask, you know, what would you do if you were asked to create a 2018 collective intelligence system really designed to solve or address the biggest problems of our time, going back to what Matthew said at the beginning, like ill health, inequality, climate, etc. And my premise is that what you would try and do is not that dissimilar to what you do in your own brain to help you think, which is a combination of elements, our ability to observe, to remember, to create, to judge, and so on. And I call these assemblies, collective intelligence assemblies, are the structured, orchestrated, and indeed partially integrated combinations of these elements in order to solve a problem. I look at some of the pointers to what that might mean in practice. Some exist in technology. So Google Maps, I think, is a really fascinating example, which probably many of you use every day or so. Google Maps began with the deliberate goal of mapping the entire geography of the world. Google recognized it had actually rather few of the skills for doing that, and so assembled a whole series of elements, partly buying up other companies for Street View and Google Earth and scrollable maps, etc. They then opened it all up with an open API so that other programmers could use Google Maps and integrate it with other things. So they tapped into a bigger mind to improve it in the sense of the software, and then through MapMaker, they opened it up so bits of the world which weren't on Google Maps any citizen could input additional elements. So it was a deliberately very sophisticated assembly of many elements of machine intelligence and many elements of human intelligence, but highly orchestrated together. Amazon does something similar in many of the ways it works. And the examples I look at are some fascinating emerging examples in fields like epidemics, global collaborations trying to spot epidemics as they break out, Zika, Ebola, etc., to use predictive algorithms to predict how they might spread, to mobilize the public to spot new outbreaks, and then feeding back into a community of practice, mainly public health officials, to deal with it. I look at examples like Planetary Skin and Copernicus doing that for the global ecosystem, again, combining these multiple elements into something beginning to look like a collective intelligence, so we can, in real time, deal with challenges of deforestation, water shortage, and so on. And here in England, actually, one of the best examples is the cancer registry within the NHS. Very, I think, little noticed, but an extraordinary pulling together of huge numbers of different data sources, observation, predictive algorithms to help patients and doctors, and beginning to link in to, citizen-patient input as well. The weird thing is, though, when you look at these in detail, and these are, to my mind, the best expressions of the potential of a bigger mind, the people doing them are improvising. There is no sort of center of knowledge in any university on the planet to really help them. There is no guidebook. There is not much theory. They have to bring together a bit of computer science, a bit of organizational theory, a bit of psychology, but they're doing it really improvising. And so where I sort of end the book and where I hope this leads, and my aim is to, I hope, encourage people, perhaps like some of you in this room, is I actually think we need a new discipline and a new profession to do this stuff well. I call it intelligence design, because in a sense it's the skill of designing systems which combine the best of our current machine intelligence, sensors, AI, etc., with the best of how we know to tap into the brains of human beings individually and collectively to solve problems. So far, the design industry has done remarkably little in this field. The computer science industry is making fantastic progress in machine learning and so on, but is surprisingly poor at understanding how to link those into real-life human decision-making in a city, in a health system, or in fields like farming. So to my mind, this is waiting to be created, a little bit like the discipline of city planning a century or more ago had to be created as a hybrid of other existing disciplines like architecture, engineering, and so on. And for me, the big sort of test of whether this book works is whether around the world we start seeing new centres of collective intelligence and intelligence design being created, whether in universities or elsewhere, to turn what I think are some very promising practices into a scale and a capability commensurate with the scale of the problems we have around us. And my very final point is this. We're here in London in the midst of an extraordinary AI bubble, or AI frenzy. Millions and millions are being invested in artificial intelligence, startups and scale-ups in the city, many fantastically impressive. The government has made this the top priority of their industrial strategy. China has committed $150 billion to AI in the next 2 or 3 years. It's creating a new AI city next to Beijing. And my fear is that we will see in the fairly near term an extraordinary imbalance between really the smartness of our tech and lamentably slow progress in advancing the intelligence of our human systems, our organizational systems, our political systems. And that seems to me a rather miserable but all too plausible future where we're headed. So the final thing I hope this book will do is encourage actually a bit of a balancing of the allocation of resources, both human resources and financial resources, because my guess is in most real-life examples, It may be fine to have an Amazon Echo in your kitchen and so on, but for solving most real-world problems, we need a new way of combining the machine and the human intelligence in order to solve problems. And if we are just observers on an entirely sort of hardware and software-driven version of intelligence, we will end up, I think, slightly miserable, but also with our biggest problems unsolved. So that is the ultimate premise of tapping into a bigger mind that, again, as Matthew said right at the beginning, probably every single other challenge facing the planet in this century depends on us making significant progress in cracking this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, I've got 43 questions. So I will discipline myself to reduce it to 5 or 6, and if you can have the discipline to answer as briefly as you can, then there'll be an opportunity for all these other people to contribute to our collective intelligence. This is an unfair question because, you know, you're promoting your book, and I enjoyed reading it. I'm just interested, though, how confident are you that your core goal, your goal of the creation of a new discipline of collective intelligence, will be successful? Do you have a hunch that it's only a matter of time until you're invited to give the inaugural lecture at the first university department, or is this a bit more of a speculative punt?
I'm pretty sure it will happen, and it's already happening to some extent. MIT has a small center for collective intelligence. There is a global academic network of several thousand researchers working in this field who meet once a year next July in Zurich, if any of you want to come. And I've since gone around many of the world's top universities having this conversation in the last 12 months. And I think many of them realize they may have fantastic capability in computer science or social psychology and so on. But unless they can pull these together, they risk missing out because they won't have anything to say if the mayor of their city or a minister comes to them and says, help me turn my health system or my city planning system into something more like what my citizens would recognize as a collective intelligence. So at the moment, they recognize there's a question there which they don't have an adequate answer to, exactly as was the case a century ago on city planning, when cities needed to become much more systematic in spatial planning and the existing disciplines weren't brought together in the right way to do that.
So there's so many challenges around that idea, and one of them is that in a sense, you know, since the birth of modern social science, people have been saying we'll get to the point where we're able to make predictions about society that are as strong as the predictions we can make about the natural world, and yet we've been confounded constantly by the fact that people don't behave like atoms or like non-sentient organisms. Or to put it even more prosaically, I mean, we could have carried on saying, well, look, if vehicles could get faster and faster, then surely human beings can get faster and faster. But it turns out that technology is able to accelerate away, and human beings have kind of feet of clay. So at the core of this is this idea that somehow human beings and society can evolve in a way which is analogous to technology. But is that right?
It's certainly the case that, you know, the ability to forecast where the economy will be in 5 years' time doesn't look as good as the ability to forecast where the stars will be in 5 years' time. But I do think we're seeing quite a lot of progress at a more micro level in abilities to understand, to have feedback loops, and to predict. So, you know, there's all sorts of examples now of this, ranging from predicting exam results across a population, predicting survival rates in cancer. The example I give of the cancer registry makes predictions on how different treatments will result in different survival patterns. Now, those aren't 100% guaranteed, thank God, but they have a reasonable level of reliability, which is dramatically more than was the case a generation ago. Many other systems like, say, transport and clean air, I think, is a really good field for collective intelligence. It's very complex how pollution, lead, particulates interact, but it is one where the combination of modelling and human input, I'm pretty confident, will enable us to have a much better handle on how those work than than was the case in the past. There may be other things about public sentiment which will be much harder to grasp, but it's only through trying to pull together the best sort of resources of intelligence available to us that we find out.
I think one of the ways in which this challenge is manifest in the book is, I mean, it reminded me of something that you once said to me, actually, many, many years ago. I think you said to me, when it comes to kind of public policy, there are some areas where there's one best way of doing things, mm-hmm. and there are other areas where there is multiple best ways of doing things, and Whitehall is basically a machine to try to pretend that there are many more things in the former category than the latter category. In your book, you have chapters which have checklists. You know, I think, oh, this is a book I understand. It's like one of those airport books that tells you 8 ways to do this or 9 ways to do that. You have a book, you have a chapter on meetings, which are the 6 ways to do a good meeting. Yeah. But then there's a pet paragraph that says, well, actually, in the end, you don't really know anything. And this always works, but sometimes it's not going to work. And it's all about context and contingency. Yeah. And you kind of move between these two accounts, the kind of technocratic and the kind of almost kind of resigned to the inherent complexity of things like organisations, for example.
Well, on the meetings chapter, since we're in a meeting right now, my premise would be that the vast majority of organisations or meeting organisers would benefit from reading that chapter, and they don't necessarily need to follow exactly its prescriptions, but I'd be pretty surprised if they didn't change their behaviour a bit by looking into that. As you say, there's an interesting, I hope where I'm consistent on this important point you raise, is on the relationship between sort of information, knowledge, data, and wisdom. So one of the fascinating things about wisdom, which is, as it were, the highest level of collective intelligence, is that what we recognize as wisdom is usually not a very standardized, universally applicable sort of toolkit or whatever, but the ability to judge appropriate context of time and place and people and culture. And that's been common to interpretations of wisdom throughout the millennia. And so one of the thought experiments I talk about a bit in the book is almost to imagine a different direction of where computing might go in the next few decades, away from standardized algorithms which you apply to everything, to a kind of computing which can mimic the best of what we recognize as wisdom, which certainly draws on data, etc., but then is much better at applying that to difference and diversity and multiple equilibria or optima rather than a single one.
So one of the small practices that we do here at the RSA in terms of collective intelligence is we have, every couple of months, we have a process where we review project proposals and we invite anybody within the organisation to come along and listen to the project pitch and respond to it. We had a slightly poignant moment on Monday, which is we had a proposal, an interesting proposal, to do a piece of work about why it is that the Education Endowment Foundation's work, one of the What Works, the biggest What Works centre, and you often talk about how good What Works centres are, that the latest research shows that there is, despite the brilliance of their work and the fact that they've made it incredibly accessible, there is not any evidence at all that it has had any impact on what goes on in classrooms. The reason for the poignancy was that we want to do some research on this, and as somebody said from the back of the room, we're doing a project on the fact that no one takes any notice of research, and the outcome of this is going to be a research report on why nobody takes any notice of research. Are we sure we have consistency in our approach? So, I mean, when you look at something like that, when you look at the fact that all that brilliant EEF evidence, which they put in their toolkit and all of that, doesn't seem yet to have demonstrated any kind of impact in relation to classrooms, does all your technocratic hope not just seep away from you?
Well, the oldest What Works Centre in this country is NICE, which is about 20 years old now. In health, is bigger than EEF. And for all its ups and downs, I think it's had quite a big impact on the practice of health. It takes quite a long time. Even NICE linked into budget allocations in the NHS, it takes 8 to 10 years for its findings to actually be implemented because human beings tend to, we're lazy. I mean, you may all be different. I don't take much notice of advice I get from the radio about what my diet should be or anything like that. So we're all resistant to information and knowledge, and teachers are no different from anyone else in that respect. I'm a bit more optimistic than you, and if you're interested, about 3 years ago at Nesta, we published a survey of the evidence about evidence, exactly this point. What have we learnt about what makes professionals or practitioners actually act on evidence or not? And it turns out there is actually quite a lot of evidence about evidence. Some of it, most of it essentially confirms that it's not just the quality of the advice or the information that matters, it's how it's said, who it comes from, how it's made easy. And we've been trying to help the other What Works centres act on that evidence. Their default, though, is just to sort of have a website which synthesizes the best available knowledge and sort of assume that people will change their behavior. That is happens very, very rarely. So, I'm more of an optimist than you about the possibility of collective intelligence and improvement. And I think this is where one needs a longer historical view. Even the EEF, I think it's, two-thirds, three-quarters of head teachers look at their evidence toolkit every month or two. They may not therefore immediately change their behaviour, but the equivalent figure would have been close to zero a generation or two ago. So, there is, I think, some cumulative progress.
And also, in the EEF's defence, they're aware of this problem and they're thinking hard about it. So that is, I guess, how you learn. But I think the other reason I asked the question is that one of the other things that you and I have experienced is when you develop a set of ideas, you critique a way of doing things, and these ideas are listened to, but then they turn into something which arguably is even worse than what you had in the first place. And I feel that a bit about at the moment about what might be defined as solutionism. That, the people turned away from the kind of tough business of policy making that you and I were involved in when we were in government in favour of kind of hackathon type approaches, service design based approaches, where we get clever people in a room and we spend a day and we attack a problem, we develop solutions, and then we give the solutions to the world, and surprise, surprise, very few of them are taken up. Are you worried about this growth of, I get slightly worried that management consultancies all seem to be buying service design companies at the moment because they've got into the solutionism game. Yeah. I find that a slightly worrying development because it's almost an abandonment of complexity. It's like, let's not talk about the politics, let's talk about power, let's not talk about interests. The problem has just got to be a clever idea.
Yeah. Well, there are various sort of intellectual and practical targets in the book. And one is a certain strand of thinking which has at times been very prominent in Silicon Valley, which has a few elements just of the kind you described. So one, I think, was the bad influence of the Wisdom of Crowds book, which said if you can only sort of post a problem online and then tap into the world's collective intelligence, a solution will come in to solve cancer or disease or whatever. And a lot of people have put it in, spent quite a lot of money trying to sort of implement that. And they do it, they have, a one-day hackathon to solve the problems of maybe urban mobility or school performance. And those always disappoint because the task of problem solving is actually a lot more complex than that, a lot more iterative, needs stages. And there's a whole chapter in the book about, I guess, where I've got to in my understanding of how problem solving really happens. And it almost never happens just by, say, posting a problem and then getting a solution in the way that sort of glib rhetoric of Silicon Valley says. But I don't therefore leap to the conclusion nothing is possible. I think we know a lot about how problems can be solved, broken down, recombined. It's just they're quite labor-intensive. And perhaps the key argument in the book, and there was I did a conversation last week with one of the US evolutionary biologists, David Sloan Wilson, on this. A key argument is actually intelligence is resource intensive. You have to put labor in. It requires structure. It requires some management. And the glib claims of some of the internet world that you could sort of bypass that to automatic solutions, self-organization, etc., has turned out to be a really dangerous sort of sidetrack, which makes things sound easy, which are, in fact, difficult. The Zuckerberg-Chan initiative with a few billion, which thinks it will, I think, solve all disease, will be an interesting example of them, rediscovering exactly the same point. Anything which matters probably requires both time and energy to solve it. But as I say, that recognizing that should be the beginning of wisdom, not the beginning of fatalism.
Final two very quick questions, then we'll open up. Yeah. I'm sure the book will do very well. It's called How Collective Intelligence Can Change the World. That's its subtitle. If it had been called How Collective Stupidity Will Destroy the World, it might have felt more of its time. I mean, there is something rather counter-zeitgeisty about putting a book writing. So how looking through a collective intelligence lens, should we understand the mass outbreak of collective stupidity, which often feels like we're wading through at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think we are in a fascinating moment where many people are afraid of the present and are afraid of the future and are taking refuge in very traditional identities or beliefs, or hope that if you invest your power in a big man, he will sort out your problems. And that's obviously happening in the US, but it's happening in other parts of the world, in India, in China, with Xi. Berlusconi is about to be elected with party in Italy, perhaps. we are seeing strong pulls in exactly the opposite direction to what this book is about. In a way, that's why, to me, it was even more important to try and set out a positive, practical, an optimistic view about how the world could avoid that fate and harness its brain power and its technologies to something positive. And my fear of what's happening around AI and digital, and I'm very involved in that field, we invest in lots of AI companies, we support them, is that if they stick relentlessly to, as it were, a hardware tech view of the future, rather than one which has a human element, rather than one which can tap into collective brain power, we shouldn't be surprised if many people are terrified by that and, say, take refuge in the past. And I think I see all of these as battlegrounds. I mean, even in the US, Trump is, in some ways, a fantastically useful sort of paradigm of collective and individual stupidity. But the way in which around him the cities, for example, have responded is really fascinating. Cities taking on the responsibility to not just protect the Paris Accord, but to advance it. Cities nurturing some really impressive mayors, some of whom may be about to stand against Trump, like Garcetti and Landrieu. Now, these are good examples of people trying to turn their cities a bit more into examples of collective intelligence, even as the federal government goes haywire.
Great. Okay, let's open it up. Now, look at that. Okay, what we'll do is we'll take kind of... Now, someone wrote to me the other day and said, don't take clusters of three, because it's too... Anyway, I'm going to do it again, but they did say, ask people to ask short, sharp questions. So, I will take groups of three, and there's three sitting here together, but try and keep them brief if you can.
So, Jeff, examples where there is good collective intelligence. You've mentioned NICE, you've mentioned Wikipedia. Are there any others you'd like to draw our attention to that we can be inspired from and put in the effort to emulate?
Yeah, possible.
I've been doing research...
Tell us your name, if you don't mind, sorry.
Sorry?
If everyone could tell us their names when you ask questions.
It's Georgia.
Thanks.
I've been doing research in group decision-making in corporate environments, especially the behavioral influences. Something that I found is social pressure. So people stop giving ideas or sharing, something that's, more innovative because they feel the pressure.
Yeah.
Have you found this as well in the research?
Yeah.
And then...
Richard Barriard, there was an article in the New Statesman a few years ago titled, Having Too Many Clever People Around Ed Miliband is Making the Labour Party Stupider. Is there any hope for political parties, or does collective intelligence have to bypass the traditional party structure?
I'll go with those three first.
Okay, well, I think one of the things the readers of the book have liked is it is full of real examples which are positive, many of which I didn't know about before the book. And just to give you three totally different examples, I think what's being done by Planet Labs with networks of satellites, small satellites, surveying the whole planet in terms of agricultural activity, industrial activity, etc., is an extraordinary breakthrough in global collective intelligence, which is hardly known at all. I mentioned Duolingo as something which many of us can sort of use freely every day. To me, that's in many ways more impressive than Wikipedia, because Wikipedia was just a sort of copy of the Oxford English Dictionary, and really, really useful. And there are Duolingo versions in other fields. And then in the field of democracy, we've worked quite a bit in the last couple of years with Barcelona and Madrid, which are implementing collective intelligence platforms in the way the cities are being run, allowing citizens to propose ideas, to comment, to vote, etc., etc. Now, they'll make plenty of mistakes. Madrid now has crowd-sourced law, which may turn out to be an interesting mistake or maybe a fascinating success. But at least they're trying to really push democracy into the 21st century, again, opposite to Trump. On the second question, there's a lot of evidence on these dynamics. For example, how within teams, people often don't say the uncomfortable information, even if it's the most useful information, for fear of upsetting peers. And that's why in the chapter on meetings, I say quite a lot about methods which try to avoid those peer dynamics, and also methods which mobilize the introverts. Because one of the problems of meetings, and especially public meetings, is the extroverts do all the talking and the introverts may have the best ideas. So again, one of the sort of meeting design issues is how do you tap into the quiet introverts who may well have the best insights. But there's lots more in there about exactly these fine-grained things, which I think are known, but are almost always ignored in how meetings are run in practice.
And Ed Miliband?
Well, political parties, again, this is where Podemos in Spain and the Pirate Party and others are. There's a lot happening in trying to reinvent the political party. Beppe Grillo, whose party is now leading the polls in Italy and is an odd party, to say the least, he invented 5 or 6 years ago. I think they've almost overshot in trying to create an entirely collective intelligence, internet-based party where the members decide on the platform, the candidates, etc. Everything is done online. But it's trying to break away from parties being run by small cliques in either committees or around a leader, and ostensibly to tap a much wider collective intelligence. As I say, I think they've almost overshot. But one of the things we did a couple of years ago, Nestor was bringing together all the new model political parties from around the world, like Five Star, Podemos, Democracy OS in Argentina, Pirates, etc., and get them to meet the British parties and say to British parties, is there anything you could learn from these guys? And they basically said, no, we don't need anything we learn.
Right, let's take three from this block here.
Hi, my name is Anna. I'm actually from Madrid, so I'm also very interested to see how it all develops. Let's see. My question is about generational change or the impact of generational change, and specifically about the speed of technology combined with a sense of searching for instant gratification, and whether that will have an impact on how we actually observe problems, how we judge the complexity of the problem, and find a potential solution.
Yeah, thank you. Pass it forward to the person in front of you. There's three people. Be quick. Yep.
Hello, my name's Clancy. This is a great idea, intelligence design and departments all over the place. I love it. But aren't we missing one very, very crucial thing, which is motive? So if I live in a very beautiful part of the city and I really enjoy the fact that I've got beautiful gardens around me and very intelligent people, and across the road my neighbours live in tower blocks that burn down and their work conditions are really, really poor, do I care? And if I do, how is intelligence design going to change other people's motives who don't?
So I'm going to reinterpret that slightly as, are you missing out power in all of this? Malcolm.
Malcolm Dean, former Guardian. Very good outlet, Jeff. Did you look at medicine? Because when initially hospitals had this system called cogwheels, which was confined to doctors, mostly. And one good thing that Mrs. Thatcher did was she put the Sainsbury head into Thomas's, and he brought out this amazing report, which said if Florence Nightingale was alive today, she'd be walking with her candle, looking through who is in charge. So I'm wondering, cogwheel was more near to you than management that followed from that, but to be controversial, I still think the management system she introduced improved it.
And then we'll take a fourth one because we missed out the lady. Yeah, did you? No, you finished. Okay, great.
Okay, well, first of all, on the sort of the generational question, I think this is a really interesting issue, whether one effect, I'll come to the good effect and then the bad effect, one of the good effects of a generation being brought up completely immersed in social media and a digital world is that it's possible anyone under 20 today almost automatically thinks of themselves as part of a collective intelligence, a hive mind. The idea of intelligence solely sitting within your cranium, which was a dominant, you know, concept for political theory and all sorts of things in the 20th century, they just seem absurdly anachronistic to generations who are quite happy to share their feelings, their lives, their experience for better or worse. So I suspect generational change will dramatically change how these things are thought about. And I hope on balance in a positive way. The negative way, of course, as you say, is that a lot of the innovations in the space where collective intelligence should be happening are instead incentivized to reinforce obsessive, compulsive, addictive behaviors in gambling or shopping or porn, all sorts of things. And in many ways, we've designed our systems to amplify the worst, not the best, of human nature. So a fair chunk of the book essentially is asking, how could we direct the same energy to reinforcing the best of our abilities to cooperate, to collaborate, to solve problems, not to become sort of, yeah, sad clickers? And I quote Jeff Hammerbacker, who was the head of data at Facebook, who lamented that the best brains of his generation were all dedicated to encouraging people to click through on adverts. What a sad misuse of incredible brilliance. And that's, you know, true right across the board. I think the other really sad misuse of intelligence is around warfare and the military, which still are probably driving more than 50% of investment in artificial intelligence and a whole part of the digital economy. So power and conflict and essentially interest being at odds with each other, as you say, if you live in a beautiful Kensington Park, what's your overlap with someone next door? Much of the literature on collective intelligence completely ignores that. And indeed, again, this is one of, I think, the weaknesses of the wisdom of crowds type sort of theories and claims, as they assumed if we all just came together and talked and hugged each other, you know, the world's problems would be solved. That's why in the book I try and look quite a lot at this as a place of conflict, where there are often very powerful interests, not just to ignore the lives of other people, but actually to distort information about them, to undermine knowledge, to derail collective intelligence. It's not just Vladimir Putin and the FSB doing that, or Trump and so on. It's true in every single field. This is a space of, you know, there's likely to be a space of conflict because power is involved. And indeed, I think if I was writing another book, it'd probably be to take that even further, because I'm more and more convinced that actually arming ourselves against the enemies of collective intelligence is as important as strengthening ourselves to be agents of it.
I'm not going to ignore your question, but it was a point as well. So I just want to take one final set of questions, if that's all right. So one, two, three. Great. Start with you. And then there's two over there.
Well, I work in the public sector and...
Who are you?
Rose, my name's Rosie. I work in the public sector and third sector in behaviour change communications. And my experience is that the best ideas always come from the audiences that we are actually trying to benefit. Mm. It's so ironic. And primary research with those audiences is the most powerful thing that I have found in planning work to benefit these audiences. So my question really is, how can we better engage people in all parts of society to pool their collective intelligence? How can we give a voice to people who don't necessarily get consulted when they absolutely should be?
Very good. We have 3 minutes for two more questions and three answers, so the clock is ticking. Yep.
Thank you. James Sheard, Smart DCC. A very quick question for you, Jeff. What are the collective intelligence aspects that you think are most significant in the world today? And what I mean by that is, where are we actually going with the collective intelligence? I didn't really get a purpose behind what you were talking about. I had a lot of method, but not much purpose. I wonder if you could just expand on that.
Why don't you hold that for your last question then? Yep.
Graham Kennedy, I'm a management consultant. How interested are you in collaborating with the Professor of Artificial Intelligence at Imperial College, who specialises in increasing the effectiveness of human and AI partnerships? And what would your desired outcomes be from such a collaboration? And I do violently agree with the point made about the importance of primary research in getting things moving.
All right, Jeff.
Well, maybe just two points then to conclude on. So from an optimistic point of view, there are quite a few sort of collective intelligence systems globally, which are pretty impressive, probably going in the right direction, and rather inspiring. Some of the smaller scale examples I gave, I think the Global Science System is one, which is now 300 years old, but it's still an extraordinary orchestration of global mind, underpinned by what Robert Merton called the communism of science, where you assume, you know, you share your knowledge, highly structured in all sorts of ways, and now with millions and millions of people involved in feeding it either as professionals or through citizen science. So there are lots of good examples, but of course that system can be used for almost any purpose, including designing a new drone to kill someone. So in terms of the question of purpose, for me, the key is to redirect these capabilities and these resources to things that matter, things that concern us. As I said, clean air in a city is an ideal sort of collective intelligence challenge, and no city on earth is yet using most of the things I describe in the book to sort of solve its problems of clean air. For that matter, public managing cancer care, coming to what Malcolm said, it was another ideal field to use these methods to harness professional knowledge, citizen-generated knowledge, machine intelligence, human intelligence to really solve problems. And that's what I hope this book will encourage to happen. Not very abstract, generic claims, but really focused problem-solving. And as that happens, it's kind of obvious, and this perhaps relates to your professor, you need to involve the people living those things. And I absolutely agree with your comment. In many of these fields, a lot of insight comes from talking to human beings about their lives, their problems, and so on. And this has been a blind spot of computer science. There's very little linking up of AI, computer science, and ethnography, anthropology, let alone sort of sociology. And yet any of these issues, air quality is a great example. If you want to solve the air quality problems of London, you have to change millions of people's daily behaviours. And those behaviours are rooted in all sorts of constraints and desires, etc. So that's what I'm trying to encourage those professors or the Alan Turing Institute and these others to engage with human beings, in a sense, in all their roundness, and to create a combination of AI and CI. Because I think that will deliver much greater benefit to the world than just ever more AI. But I mean, a final point to end on. I'm sure I'm wrong about lots of these things. And as I said right at the beginning, one of the things which is why this institution exists is how collective intelligence, whether in science or politics or any field, advances through argument. So I would urge you, read the book, strongly agree with some of it, but strongly disagree with other bits. Tell me where I'm wrong. And, let's improve it. It will be out of a really robust, vigorous argument that we get the tools commensurate with the scale of the problems we have to solve.
So I don't know whether you've had that experience of going to see a film and not being sure you completely get it, and then someone saying, what do you think of the film? And going, well, I'm not sure I completely got it. And then them saying, well, didn't you notice this and the way that this connected with this and that wonderful thing and the way they used the background, then you think, oh, yeah, it was a great film. I didn't notice all that stuff. Now, I wasn't sure I got this. Having heard you talk about it, Jeff, I do get it. And I think it's incredibly exciting. You have all got the advantage of having heard him before you read the book. So you'll get even more out of it than I did. So I endorse Jeff's endorsement of his own book. I encourage you to get it. It's available outside. I'm sure Jeff will sign it for you. It just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Jeff Mulligan.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.